Blues singer Candy Kane is here today. She is a large woman who financed her music and her life as a single mom by working in the sex trade, mostly as a model for men's magazines. She is a born performer, one of the most charismatic people we've ever had on the Cafe. And to hear her tell it, originally she wasn't particularly a blues fan. It was country that was her first love.
That's true. I mean, I was just exposed to what was, you know, in my household. And my mom and dad actually had quite an eclectic mix of music, like kabuki music and soundtracks and Bobby Darin and Patsy Cline. So I learned some Patsy Cline stuff early. But I came to country more because of songwriters like Carly Simon and Linda Ronstadt, who were my era. They were played on the radio when I was a kid. And Linda Ronstadt had recorded a bunch of Hank Williams songs. And so then I went to the library and I found Hank Williams and Jimmy Rogers and, you know, Elton Britt and all kinds of, and Hank Snow, you know, and I really started getting into hillbilly music. And I still have sort of a hillbilly lonesome thing. For many long years, I played a lone hand. You know, I could do that if I would love to do a hillbilly record sometime, but I think the blues was more a better fit for me. And I think because of my life and my life experiences, the blues really spoke to me in a big way. Big women were in the blues. Country was always trying to change me and make me into something I wasn't. Oh, you're okay as long as you are blonde and thin and are a bad girl gone good, then, you know, or at least play that image, then you can be successful. And the blues didn't really make limitations like that.
Well, that actually, I mean, you're actually talking about that actually happened. You almost had a record deal. Well, you had a record deal with Epic. And
yeah, and 1986.
When they wanted to. And of course, you also came up in a time in music in Los Angeles, where you're from, where that kind of country music was kind of really happening in the punk scene.
I think there was a really supportive environment, as Guilty, our bass player who played in Top Jimmy and the Rhythm Pigs, would tell you. There was a scene in LA where you could see rockabilly bands like the Blasters, and you could see, you know, Norteño bands like Los Lobos and country bands like Lone Justice. And I had a rockabilly band with Jerry Sikorsky, who was had a band called American Patrol. I sang with him first, and then I had my own country bands. Blood on the Saddle was like a country punk band. So it was a really mutually supportive environment where people who were all bucking the system and not playing the major label game were supported, and it was, you know, reciprocal.
Well, we want to hear more about your story and how you got where you are today. But let's let some people understand exactly why you're here and do a tune.
All right. Well, we've got this new CD, White Trash Girl, and this is a song. Actually, it's 11 Spoonful song, but we remade it into a blues shuffle, and it's a happy song called What a Day for a Daydream.
I'm
Daydream. Candy Kane and her band are with us live today on the World Cafe. Candy, why'd you pick that song?
I just love that song. I mean, I think it's so happy, and I have sort of a attraction to happy songs. I did Get Happy on one of my records. I did Dream a Little Dream of Me, which is also sort of a happy song. And I just think it has a beautiful bounce to it, sort of like a 20s, you know, it floats along, and it's an uplifting song, and it sounds great as a blues shuffle, I think.
Yeah, totally different take on it. Now, you mentioned some of the music you heard growing up. Where'd you grow up, and what did your parents do?
Well, I grew up in Northeast L.A., and my dad was an artist who also worked as a Teamster truck driver and, you know, a struggling artist. And my mom was a legal secretary. She still works as a secretary now for the LAPD. And so it was definitely a working class family. And my dad was a guitar player. He played flute. My real dad actually was in prison. I never met my real dad till I was 18. And when I did meet him, he was a Jehovah's Witness, which is a whole other story. But my stepdad was really artistic and colorful. And he used to body paint naked women in the 60s. I used to go to the beach and hang out on the beach. And I thought everybody's dad did that. You know, I didn't realize it was a, you know, sort of counterculture thing. But because of my dad, I think, you know, my dad also had a job at one point being a graphic artist for Adam's Film World, which was a porn magazine, and he used to illustrate Bible coloring books. So I got a real healthy dose of you can be religious and you can be sexual and it's all okay, and it was sort of a free kind of environment around my house.
And you got a scholarship to study music in L.A.?
Yeah, I auditioned for a program at the USC Music Conservatory that was for at-risk kids because I was in a poor neighborhood. And they wanted me to be an opera singer, but I really didn't have a lot of interest in opera. I wanted to sing the songs that I was hearing on the radio, like, you know, Carole King and Carly Simon. And so I didn't really want to be an opera singer. And at the same time, there were a lot of, you know, environmental things happening. I mean, it was East LA, so it was a tough neighborhood. I had to really, I got transferred from several schools for getting in fights, and that weren't my doing. You know, if you are in a fight, you're transferred. So I was in some pretty rough schools, and I learned early that music could make people happy and maybe be a buffer against violence. And I ended up, you know, getting pregnant young and putting some of my musical aspirations on hold.
So that seems to be, for a lot of people in your situation, kind of a key thing about getting pregnant young, and it kind of cuts off a lot of things you might want to do. Now, that was when you became a sex worker, or when you started doing pictorials and stuff?
Yeah, you know? I had Evan here when I was 17. So by the time I was 18, I started working as a, you know, phone sex girl, and then working as a stripper and doing topless modeling and some video work. And it was actually a really, I mean, ironically, it gave me a lot of confidence. All of a sudden, I wasn't just a chubby girl from East LA. I was a chubby girl making a bunch of dough, and I got off welfare and became financially emancipated and really was able to subsidize my art. And I think that's a struggle that a lot of poor people deal with, how to find a way to do what they're really meant to do. Not only a way economically, but just a way out. There's not a lot of talent scouts coming back to East LA, you know, trying to scout for little chubby white kids. So it was, or chubby Mexican kids for that matter. So it's, you know, it's kind of tough. But I used that as a vehicle. And as you mentioned earlier, the punk rock scene of the early 80s in Hollywood was a really supportive environment for me. I was, you know, a sex worker who yodeled and in punk rock clubs. So I was sort of a punk rock anarchist along with all of my musical contemporaries.
Now, what did the musicians think of your sex work life?
Nobody cared about that. Nobody ever judged anybody. It was a very sexually free time. It was sort of, you know, pre-AIDS explosion, and there was a lot of sexual exploration going on anyway. So I don't think it was stigmatic, and I certainly didn't feel it was stigmatic. I mean, it was a little naive, but I really thought it was famous when I saw myself on the cover of Jugs. It was on the same rack as Time and People, and I just felt like the transition, it would be a natural transition.
I guess the other part of that is, what did the people, you know, running the strip clubs think of you being a musician? Was that, were they supportive of your art, shall we say?
Well, no, not exactly. I mean, I felt like, for a long time that it was a supportive environment. And then one time I pulled out my guitar on stage at Market Street Cinema in San Francisco and tried to play a song topless, and the manager's voice came out over the loudspeaker like, God, put down that guitar and show us your G-string. So that was the last time I stripped on stage. I realized then that it wasn't a supportive environment. I think it could be, but it isn't yet.
I can't imagine listening to you talk now. You have such awareness of who you are and what it meant to be in these two worlds. Did that come at that time? Or I understand there is some college in your past. You took some courses in feminism and feminist
women's thought. Women's studies. Yeah. Well, I will say that I always perceived it as a positive thing. I mean, I was so excited when I was on the cover of Gent that I ran home and showed my mother. She was not very pleased about it. But I didn't realize that I didn't understand why it was okay for Dad to be a body painter and work on, you know, porn magazines, but it wasn't okay for me. And it took a while for me to sort of grasp that it was a cultural stigma. But I knew it was a positive thing because I became financially emancipated. I got off welfare. I was able to hire good musicians to play with me. I had money to make demos, and so I knew it was empowering, but I didn't know how to articulate that until I went to college for a while when my second son was an infant and started realizing, like, sex-positive feminist wasn't in my vocabulary yet, and it wasn't until I went and took, like, you know, human sexuality and women's studies and women's history in college that I found other kindred spirits like Annie Sprinkle and Carol Queen, who were academics, you know, Susie Bride and Nina Hartley, who spoke about this issue and were also like me.
Boy, the people who taught those classes must have loved you. I mean, you must have been really an interesting student for them.
I had a great time in college. I wish I could be in college my whole life.
Well, now, let's talk a little more about the music and how this transition from country punk, et cetera, into more of a blues performer came about. Was that a part of the marketplace, or how did that work for you?
Well, the first person to encourage me to sing blues was my buddy Guilty here. He was always telling me, you should listen to Ruth Brown. Why don't you listen to Ruth Brown? And I was really a country snob. I mean, I felt like I had Kitty Wells, the Carter family, Wanda Jackson. I didn't feel like Patsy Cline. I didn't feel like I needed to move from country. But I ended up getting married to Tom Yearsley, who's the bass player from the Paladins, and he had a rich blues record collection. And for the first time, I heard Elmore James and Magic Sam and, you know, Howlin' Wolf, and those voices just really spoke to me. And then I started doing a lot of investigating of blues women and collecting records of my own, you know, and not only just blues women, but Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan and Dinah Washington and some fine jazz singers too. So I really, once I discovered women like Bessie Smith, Big Maybelle, Big Mama Thornton, Alberta Hunter, Memphis Minnie, I discovered women who were writing songs sometimes about sexual content, sometimes large-sized women, women who'd had rough lives, who'd been challenged economically, and it really spoke to me, and I realized that I could find a place here.
Well, it's also interesting, you know, you think about the early blues piano players, the professors, they were all playing in what they called body houses. Come on, they were brothels. So it's interesting that the two come together in that way.
In the Bessie Smith book by Chris Anderson, it talks about how Bessie used to play in the, you know, lobby of the whorehouse, and then at night sometimes, you know, selectively choose a date and go up and make a little bit extra cash on the side. So it was an interesting time, I think, for music.
Well, let's hear some of your originals. What do you want to do next?
Well, I'd like to do this song with Smedley called I'm Not Getting Older, I'm Getting Better. If since you were talking about the piano players of that time and playing in, you know, bathhouses and brothels and stuff, this is a perfect example of a kind of ragtime barrel house tune. That way, I'm
not getting older, I'm getting better. At least that's what I say. I can work it a little, I can work it a lot. Everybody's got to work the stuff they got. I'm not getting older, I'm getting better. I plan to keep it that way. I plan to keep it that way. Play it for me, Smithy. Getting smaller, I'm getting bigger, and that's all right with me. I'm not getting smaller, I'm getting larger, on that you may agree. I can shake it all night, I can shake it all day. When I start shaking, but I'll move out of the way. I'm not getting older, I'm getting better. I plan to keep it that way. I plan to keep it that way. I really mean it. I plan to keep it that way.
I'm not getting older, I'm getting better. Candy Kane and Smedley B on the piano. Candy, why don't you go around the room and introduce who all's here in the band.
Smedley B here is from Thunder Bay, Ontario, Canada. It's great to have him here. And Big Gil T over here is originally from Echo Park, now lives down in Austin, Texas. Has played with all kinds of great famous bands like the Pleasure Barons, W.C. Clark, Guy Forsythe, and of course Top Jimmy and the Rhythm Pigs. Over here on the drums is my son Evan Caleb on the drums. He's 25 and a great, great drummer. And over here on guitar we have Isaiah Honeyboy Mitchell. He's a real great guitar player. He's played all kinds of different styles of music, but really loves the blues.
What do you want to finish up with?
We're going to do this song, Estrogen Bomb. It's actually a song that was written by a friend of mine named Mike Duke, who's a fine songwriter, wrote a lot of big hits for Huey Lewis and a lot of other famous performers. He wrote this song and nobody recorded it, I guess maybe because nobody wanted to admit that they were 40 and knew what hot flushes were in estrogen. But yeah, I'm 40 and I'm not ashamed. I've never been one to hide who I am and what I'm about. So I did this song and it's surprising, but women love this song. I mean, it's really kind of nips it in the bud what it's like to get older, get better, but a little crazier as well.
Candy Cane dropping the estrogen bomb. That is another one from White Trash Girl, the current album out on Rough Records. Candy, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you. Thanks so much for supporting us and for playing us on your beautiful station.
Candy Cane, our guest, and we shall return in a moment here to the World Cafe. Thanks again to Candy Cane. That new album, White Trash Girl, is available at our World Cafe CD store on your web browser at worldcafecds.com.